They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Joining us today on the show is John Cowherd, who's been out for a while, but we're happy to have him back. John, I know you've been busy, and I know you have a whole lot of interesting stuff that you want to share with us. So you've had some cases. We've been talking about some ideas, bouncing around ideas, and some of the items that has been going on, and we'll try to get to as many of them as we possibly can. So thanks for joining us today, John.
Thank you, Sue. It's great to be back. I've had so many wonderful changes in my life since I was last on this wonderful radio show. In September, my second child, another daughter, was born. And
another beauty.
Yes, another beauty. And I've been very busy taking care of her and my family. And I also moved my office from Tyson's Corner to Oakton for a number of reasons, and that's been a great move for me. And I've had a lot more new cases lately, especially condominium and HOA cases. So there's been a lot of changes since we last spoke, and it's exciting stuff to be a part of.
So it seems that every time you have a baby, you move your office, or maybe it's every time you move your office, you have a baby. But there's a correlation there, John. You're going to have to watch that.
Well, I've got a great new landlord. It's a law. My landlord now is a law firm that does almost exclusively commercial landlord tenant and sales.
Oh, cool.
And so we. It's a good fit because we can just talk real estate law, and it's just lends itself towards that, and it's a lot more fun to be in that kind of environment than someplace else where people don't share your interests.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but this field, a lot of people really don't understand it. Unless they've been caught in it, and then it comes like a screaming Mimi's, we need to do this, that, and the other. And it's not always the right answer.
And I guess I'm one of the few people who actually think that community associations law and neighbor disputes law is very interesting. And I enjoy learning new things about it, and I enjoy trying to tease out solutions to puzzles and problems and resolving disputes that may seem intractable. And sometimes I kind of feel like it's weird because there's so many people who view it as just simply a nightmare that doesn't end, when in fact it can be a nightmare, and I've worked with people who are in that nightmare, but it doesn't have to be that way.
It doesn't have to be that way, and I think one of the big issues that we have in this country is that we've empowered a small segment of the neighborhood and given them unbelievable powers through the legislature, and those powers are being abused. And I think that if you want to go back to having neighborhoods and neighbors, that we need to start deregulating some of this stuff, and we need to start taking away these powers. I'd love to see an end to fines,
That's ridiculous.
Right. I agree with you. I think fines and foreclosures and liens, these are all things that are just so ripe for abuse in the community association's context. I think, you know, you and I like to talk about deregulation, and I think we kind of know what we're talking about when we mean that, but I think it, let me just try to clarify, when I think about the word deregulation, to me that doesn't mean that there is chaos, it doesn't mean there's anarchy, it doesn't mean that there's a lack of order or rules. What that means to me is that instead of, what you would do is you would remove some of these statutes that give the associations and their allied commercial interests and affiliates these powers that they don't really need, that just kind of serve to make it easier for them to do debt collection and other abuses. And you would go back to a more even playing field where you would, you know, if the property owner has a problem with their HOA, then they have to bring a civil suit to resolve it. If the HOA has a problem with the unit owner, they have to bring a civil suit to resolve it, and they don't get to act as judge, jury, and collection agent and sheriff in their own, in cases that are their own, where they're a party. I think it's, that's what I think, when I think of deregulation, that's what I think of. You know, it reverts back to a simpler understanding of what it means to have a real estate contract between different property owners in the same subdivision.
See, when you go back in history historically and you look at why we have associations, and as you mentioned earlier, to provide local municipalities with a way of increasing their tax base without, you know, they're collecting the taxes and not spending it, so it's free tax money. We're stuck with the extras. So now you come along with these people who say, oh, well, we need to make extra money. Well, when this whole thing started, and let me backtrack, when this whole thing started, the whole thing was set up through a declaration. And if there was a dispute, you went to court, and the judges looked at the declaration. Is this part of the contract that you agreed to? And inevitably, the homeowners won, because before I got on the board, when I started to get interested in this, I went down to the courthouse, and I started looking through cases that involved HOAs, and the cases were absolutely ridiculous. I'll give you one example from my association, and that was the Witches Tree case. Somebody had a friend come and paint a tree, an apple tree, on top of the front door. But after he'd painted the trunk, and before he got involved in painting the leaves and the apples and all that, the homeowner came home and found his best friend, the artist, the painter, in bed with his wife. So he fired his friend, and they ended up with what looked like a witch's tree. It was just a dark, the trunk and the branches and all that. Ended up in court, and it was resolved very quickly because the judge looked at the covenants, and the covenants restricted painting and paint colors only to the single-family homes, not to the townhouses. This happened to be a townhouse. Homeowner won. It was not this protracted years' worth of going in and out and hundreds of thousands of dollars of legal fees and all right. The name-calling and all of the, you know. It was just a very simple case. You don't have association. You don't have the right to enforce this because there's nothing in the contract that gives you the right.
Right.
Now you add all of these enabling statutes that the industry has come along and begged for, and a lot of the homeowners have come along and said, oh, well, we're going to tweak this and we're going to tweak that, and it's going to make it so much better. Now you've got an incredible amount of nonsense to plow through. It'll take years and years and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you create an entire war zone. So that's what you and I are talking about.
Right, exactly. And it's if you go into court and you have an acrimonious dispute between people who can barely be in the same room together, the judge is going to take the contract between the parties, whether it's a declaration of covenants or whatever other kind of dispute it is, and they're going to apply that contract to the facts of the case. And that's just what you should expect. And that sounds like that's what happened in your case. The problem with a lot of these statutes is that some people out there don't like some of the older covenants because they just don't give the boards all the powers that they want the boards to have, or they don't make it easy to do certain things that they want to do, you know, that would cost more to collect certain debts and makes it harder to collect fines and assessments. And it, for example, let me make an example. You've spoken about how these HOAs and condominiums are very attractive to cities and counties because it allows them to essentially farm out or delegate out the responsibility to maintain roads and sidewalks and parks and things and trash removal and all the stuff that you normally think of as being a municipal obligation. So they can pocket the tax money and then require these associations to collect assessments to pay for trash, you know, snow removal and weed whacking and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't stop there. What happens is that what you're seeing in a lot of the newer covenants is that the associations will, or the declarants, the developers, will put language in that absolves the HOA of the responsibility to do these things in a safe and non-harmful manner. For example, let's say there's a flooding problem, whether it's in a condominium with leaky pipes or a faulty drainage system in a homeowners association. Let's just say that a common area or a common element was poorly maintained, and the result of that is it floods a unit or a lot and causes damage. under some of the older covenants, there's no indemnification or waiver or shifting of the burden to pay for the repairs. So a property owner can bring suit and recover damages for the damage to their property. But some very clever people realized that if you put language into these declarations that either shifts the burden to pay for insurance or indemnifies or holds harmless the boards or property managers for such damage, then suddenly a big burden is taken off them as far as what they have to, the insurance they have to maintain, the reserves they have to maintain. So what you're seeing is not only is there a problem on the locality versus HOA level, but even down below that, between the associations and the owners, there's this tendency to just figure out a way so you can either tax or assess people for something and then delegate back to them the duty to maintain it themselves. And I mean, it's that kind of thing that this is one reason why I don't like amendments to declarations and bylaws, because it just opens up a whole can of worms where you just lay the groundwork for taking benefits of a contract away from one party, the owners, and giving that benefit to the association, the industry, board itself.
Yeah.
And it's just it's just ripe for abuse.
Well, it is. It's abused all the time, and that's been a huge problem. This might be a good time to warn people. I've seen so many industry attorneys, so many attorneys who represent associations, come into an association and say, oh, your declaration is so out of date. We need to rewrite it, and we need to come up with a new one and make it comply with the law. Listen, guys, that's baloney. That's sheer and utter nonsense. No declaration doesn't comply with the law. You've got a valid contract between the association and the homeowners. Laws can come in, the laws don't apply and can't change the covenants. They can take away from them, but they can't really change them. And what they're trying to do is give the board and the association powers that they already don't have. So don't fall for that it doesn't comply with the law. John, what do you, am I right? Am I wrong?
I agree with you. I mean, it sounds to someone who is kind of unfamiliar with a lot of these things and who's experiencing difficulties with their property manager, their board of directors, or their president, to think, wow, and if we could just change the governing documents and fix them, then they wouldn't be able to abuse these things. Or they think, well, I can't get a majority, a 75% or 66% majority to support me. I can't even get people to talk to me. Maybe if I can get a delegate or a senator in my state legislature to pay attention to this issue, maybe we can enact some legislation. I mean, there is a potential for amendments to governing documents to be used in a way that is fair to property owners, but as we both know, that rarely ever happens.
No, it doesn't.
And the reason it doesn't happen is because it's very difficult for a single homeowner or a small group of homeowners to get 75%, two-thirds or 75%, or even a majority signatures to make a change to something without the support of...
Without lying, or without the support
of the board or the property manager or the association's attorney. And so usually what you see are these amendments are being pushed through by the board of directors and their property manager and the attorney.
Yeah.
So they're coming from that direction. And usually, I mean, almost always when these things are being pushed through, it's not... They're representing those interests, not to clean up problems that an owner would be focused on or what have you. And it can be very confusing to understand what's happening with these amendments. I mean, first of all, these covenants and the amendments and the bylaws are very difficult to understand. They're not written in a way that someone who's not experienced in working with these kinds of things.
Or even attorneys don't understand.
Right. You know, even a lot of attorneys don't understand them. And, you know, even, and some of them are so poorly written that nobody knows what they mean.
Yeah.
I mean, even people who've been practicing real estate law or community associations law for 10 or 20 or 30 years. And that's a problem. Another problem is that if there's an amendment, as I mentioned before, it seems like amendments are just such a ripe area for abuse because they can sort of open the door to other abuses.
Yeah,
they can open the door to defines or to foreclosures or to all sorts of other things like note shifting obligations to pay for repairs. They can establish arbitration as opposed to other ways of resolving disputes. There's all sorts of, I mean, the number of ways that you can change governing documents in a way that makes things difficult for homeowners to protect themselves is only limited by your imagination when it comes to these amendments. And it's not always apparent what people are trying to do with these amendments and what their motives are. Another problem is, how do you know whether an amendment is valid? How do you figure that out? I mean, is it apparent from its face? Is it something do you have to go and look at the declaration to see how you amend it? Do you go and look at some state statute to see how you amend it? Is there a constitutional issue at play? The answers to those questions are not just handed to people when they're presented with a proxy. No, that's not explained, and it's
on purpose.
Sometimes how you would go about amending a declaration is something that is not the lawyer who is advising the board may not be sure how a judge or an appeals court would view what they had done after it's done. They just kind of push it through and see what happens.
In the early days when associations were first being built, and they had these boilerplate declarations, they just kept copying them. This was before we had computers and everything was computerized. If you go to the courthouse, you'll see one association after another, and as it gets copied, it gets lighter, the ink gets lighter, and you can tell as it gets down the generations, and it's sort of hard to read sometimes. But originally, if you go and do that, and I've done that, I mean, that's the sort of thing I did when I was going on the board and I needed to understand what I was getting into and what I was doing. One thing I realized is in the beginning, it took something like 90% of all homeowners, an affirmative vote of 90% of all homeowners to amend the documents. Now, these were declarations written by CAI-affiliated attorneys. I can give you the names. I know the attorneys. And then they said, and the reason they did that was because they didn't want the homeowners making any changes. They didn't want them to water down the powers that they already had, that they'd given themselves. But then as they got enabling legislation passed, they decided they wanted to change that. They wanted to make it simpler because 90% affirmative vote was impossible. So now they wanted to change that down to 51%. So half of your neighbors can change the terms of the contract you signed.
Right. It's unheard of in any other context, right?
And is that really what you want? Do you really want your neighbors to be able to change the contract? Whether you wanted to get in the contract or not is immaterial. The fact is they can come in and make all these damned alterations because CAI said, oh, do you know how difficult it is to amend the documents with 90% affirmative vote or even 75% after 10 years or 25 years or whatever it was?
Right, right. I mean, I think people sometimes don't understand that covenants, declaration of covenants, were not invented by the HOA industry when they were starting up these associations back in the 1970s. These things, covenants go back the existence of covenants goes back hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yes.
From the first day that people realized that you could make a contract with your neighbor and then record it in the land records and hope that it would bind somebody, an owner, a purchaser that your neighbor would sell the property to. I mean, that's the origin of these things. In that origin, before you had all these HOA and condominium statutes and non-stock corporation acts and so on, if you wanted to amend, let's say you got a bunch of people to sign off on a declaration of covenants, or you put the developer put it in, or something like that. First of all, the judges were very, very skeptical against these things and did not like enforcing them. And there was that skepticism wasn't simply a prejudice; it was a doctrine of real estate law, mm-hmm. which was that covenants are not normally deemed to run with the land when a property is sold. It has to really be something where you've really met all these very strict requirements. and under that old view, in order to amend a covenant, you had to have 100% consent, consent amongst all the amongst all the unit owner, the lot owners that were subject to that covenant in order to amend it.
Yeah.
And that's the way that it was except before you had these statutes come in. And the only exception to that, well, I won't say only. I'm sure there's somebody out in your listening audience who knows some other exception. But the main exception to that 100% rule was if you were to put something in the original declaration that allowed for an alternative means of amending it that was less than 100%, then the courts probably would enforce that if you complied strictly to the letter of that those requirements when you're dotting all your I's and crossing all your T's for an amendment with less than 100% consent. And that's still the law if, let's say, in Virginia, if in Virginia you have a lot of associations out there, which aren't really even associations. They were created by people who, for whatever reason, either intentionally or due to negligence, did not set them up in a way that made them, that brought with them with them within the scope of the HOA statutes. So they're just, I call them non-statutory HOAs, but they're really just sort of these creatures of covenants that don't enjoy all these special privileges we've been talking about that the General Assembly has given people who qualify for them. And in those I won't call them HOAs, and those
developments
or whatever, the parties to those covenants, they have to either have 100% consent or they have to comply with the there's no magical statutory allowance for doing something other than the strict requirements. And so I can see how we got from there to what you're talking about. People thought, well, if we get it 90%, that's at least we can take care of those holdouts, those kind of grumpy people who won't sign anything. And then from there, it became watered down further to what we have now, where in many places you can do it by 51%,
yeah.
and you don't
by
even...
By statute.
Right.
By statute. And they'll go in and say, look, the law says, it's not the law, it's what's in your governing documents, and you need to stick to that. Always read what's in your governing documents.
Absolutely. And if you read them and you can't understand them, you need to find somebody who can help you understand them. And that might not be easy. It's very hard for property owners to find professional assistance in these kinds of things, because how do you know where to look? I mean, if you,
that's just it.
It's very difficult, and you know, it's I was looking at the statutes the other day for amendments in Virginia, and there is a 1-year statute of limitation to challenge the validity of an amendment.
Yeah.
So let's say that your board wants to push through an amendment to give themselves extra powers, and for whatever reason, you know, a bird came along and snatched away the letter, the notice letter for that meeting out of your mailbox, and you didn't know that a meeting was taking place. And then they had a meeting and they amended the declaration so that something happened to take away, that in effect takes away some of your rights or your ability to challenge certain things. And then a year goes by, and unless you happen to have heard from somebody about this, somebody had tipped you off, or you had gone down to the land records or sent somebody down the land records to do a search, after a year, you have no way of challenging it, even if it was adopted in a way that was completely in disregard of the rules. And, you know, in Virginia, like elsewhere, a 1-year statute of limitations, a 1-year deadline on which to challenge something or to bring a suit is very, very harsh. because in generally speaking, if you want to sue someone for breach of contract in Virginia, you get 5 years for a written contract. But here, someone's amending a declaration where they could be taking away rights from unit owners and shifting that over to benefit the board, and you only get 1 year in which to challenge something that you may not even have known about. That's what I'm talking about.
You know who wrote that one? The industry, because they don't want anybody challenging it. There was a bill that didn't pass that said you couldn't keep trying to amend something in perpetuity. So in other words, if an association decided they wanted, like my association, they wanted to be able to fine you for parking, not improper parking. And they kept that, they carried these ballots around, the board members carried these ballots around with knocking on doors and getting people to sign over their proxies to vote for this thing. And it just went on for years until they had the requisite number of ballots, of proxies, to make the amendment. And this bill had said, you know, you can't do that. You only have, like, I don't know how long, a month or whatever, to get this completed. And if not, then you'll have to start from the beginning. And, of course, that bill died, and I wonder who killed it again.
There's another thing, another practice that I've just run across that has come to my attention. I wouldn't say I've had a case on it, but it's come to my attention. Let's say that somebody decides that they want to terminate a condominium or they want to amend the covenants of an HOA or a condo. But they don't know when they want to do it. They just want to preserve the power to do it. So let's say they go and they collect all the signatures they need, or the proxies, or they hold a meeting and they adopt some amendment. What's to stop them from just taking that amendment and putting it in a desk drawer and waiting to see if something else happens, and then depending upon what somebody does or doesn't do, or depending on what happens in the future, you just have a pocket amendment that if you need to frustrate someone or take away their rights, you can just pull it out of your desk drawer and have it filed. And then it's like you can see how there's a real potential for abuse there, because you could have a whole bunch of these things that you pushed through, people not understanding what they were signing, but have no deadline by which it has to be recorded, otherwise it's invalid. And then you have all these things in your desk drawer, and then let's say that somebody decides that they want to bring legal action to protect themselves against something bad that's happening, and then you just pull something out of your desk drawer and file it in the land records. You know, Is that the way that you're supposed to have an amendment that reflects the consensus of a community to make the community better?
Consensus? No. Community? What's that? You know, some of them, and it's great that you mentioned that, because I always tell people, make sure you go to the land records and get a copy of the latest document that's recorded, because if it's not recorded, it's not valid. I've heard of associations that have a number of different declarations in their drawer, and they pull out whatever it is they need to rely on. You come in and you say, you can't do that, it's not in there. Oh, well, we amended it, and here it is. So they'll have it sitting there.
Right.
And they'll pull it out, and it's not recorded. It's just something they wrote up. It's whatever, you know, whatever's going to help them make their case right then and there. John, you've been in court. You said you've had a lot of interesting cases. I know you've done some condo terminations. Is there anything there that you want to share with us? Any of your cases that
I actually just settled one recently that is unfortunately I'm not able to talk. I'll say a whole lot about it for reasons you can imagine.
Yeah.
But I've had some interesting things going on in court. Now you're kind of putting me on the spot about how do I appreciate that. Condominium terminations, I think, are very interesting. I've actually litigated two of them. They're pretty rare, but I've had the opportunity to litigate two of them, which is more than probably two more than just about everybody, and one mm-hmm. more than a lot of people. I've given this a great deal of thought, and it's different in different states. There are different statutes in different states, but I think that there's nothing, in my mind, there is nothing more ripe for abuse in terms of invading the property rights of a unit owner than in the termination context. I really don't like, I'm not talking about anything in any of my cases right now. So mm-hmm. I'm just talking
it's just
about
in general.
In general, the Virginia Condominium Act provisions that deal with termination are, I mean, in my opinion, I'm biased, and I'm very happy to be biased, but I'm pretty open about my bias. But I think that the Virginia Condominium termination provisions are perhaps the worst legislation that I've ever seen, and really need to be amended. Let me just explain the basics of why I believe that. Under the old rules back in the 1970s, in the mid 1970s, they changed the rules of the game to make it easier for developers to do things with condominium terminations. It was the 1990s, 1993, I believe, when they made these changes. Under the old rules, the rules were set up in a way that that very much discouraged any condominium terminations. If you wanted to do it, unless there was something special in your declaration, what you had to do was you had to get a two-thirds majority to agree to terminate, and then you would file a certificate of termination in the land records. And when you filed that certificate, all the real estate in the condominium complex would no longer be owned individually by the unit owners, and then common areas would be owned by the association. It all became owned by the unit owners as tenants in common, and then they had to figure out what to do with it. Tenants in common is perhaps the worst way for different people who don't like each other or agree with each other to own property, because it just means that you've got a bunch of people who essentially, it's like buying a house with somebody that you're not married to. You just buy the house and then you both own it, but there's no way to dispose of it or to sell it. And those situations just naturally lend themselves towards people arguing about how much of a share they should get or who it should be sold to or what price it should be sold at. And the only way to resolve a tenancy in common under Virginia law is through something called through partition.
Mm-hmm.
And in partition allows the court to either divide up the property and parson it out between different people and give them each different parts of the property, subdivide it, or the court can hold a sale and sell off all the property and then divide up the proceeds of the sale. This whole process is very acrimonious and very difficult and very time-consuming and very expensive. People would say, well, what good is that? Well, what's good about it is it discourages opportunistic investors and developers from parachuting into these condominium complexes and trying to do one of these termination and sales, because the costs of doing it it just makes it impractical.
Mm-hmm.
But some people decided that this wasn't good because it meant that property might not be developed to its full potential, and you know, there's no money to be made. So they decided that they would adopt this new statute in Virginia, which was this amendment that was enacted in the early 1990s. And what this does is that it preserves the old method where you terminate, it becomes owned by tenants in common, and then you partition it. You can still do that, but the amendments that are enforced, that are in effective now, they create a special way to bypass all of this, all these protections that protect the homeowners. Because if you think about it, if you're a homeowner and you know that a developer or a board or some group of people who are trying to take away your condominium unit and to sell it to somebody else and give you what they think you deserve out of the proceeds of that sale, you know, you're protected by all these procedures that make that difficult. But under this new amendment, it delegates to the board of directors a power of sale to sell the property outside of a court proceeding. So instead of one party having to initiate a partition civil suit to figure out what to do with this terminated property, if certain criteria are met that are laid out in the statute, then the board of directors can enter into a contract to convey the property to somebody and then take the money and then disperse the money to the unit owners according to a set of appraisals. Well, it sounds great, right? It sounds great because you don't have to pay a bunch of lawyers to fight over partition. You can do things that you weren't able to do before, but you know, you're not, you know, people who are afraid of having to navigate the legal system might feel initially comforted by this. But the problem is that if you've got a majority who has a voting block sufficient to determinate and to sell the property, they're going to control the board of directors because they have 2/3 or 3/4. They're going to control the board of directors. They're going to have such a strong majority on the board that the board doesn't even really need to have votes because they know what they're going to do. So whether it's a bulk buyer, like a big developer who goes in and buys a big segment, or a group of very organized people who want to do something, they get to sell your property, and they get to choose what the price is for the sale, and they get to choose what expenses are deducted out of that sale, taken off the top before you get your share. And you can see how this is just the potential for abuse here is it's worse than eminent domain and takings and condemnation. It's worse because at least in those contexts you have state and federal constitutional protections against wrongful takings of private property. Here, you have to it is less clear to a lot of people how you would defend against something like that. I've developed some ideas, but you know, there's just really no case law guidance on how to deal with these things.
I think the first time I encountered this was through Florida when I had people contacting me, and the condo owners were losing huge things because they'd had these bulk buyers and their units that had been paid for, and they'd worked hard to pay for them, and they were getting next to nothing for them because it was the buyer who was telling them what they could get, in essence what you were talking about.
Right.
So, you know, when you talk about all the glories about condominium ownership, you're going to have a homeowner, you're going to have carefree living, someone else is going to mow the grass for you. nobody really looks at all of the bad sides. This is definitely one of them. And the other one is, of course, you've got that story out of California where they've neglected to fund the reserves and there's $145,000 special assessment.
Right. Or there's
affordable living. Yeah.
Or there's a structural problem. There's an earthquake or something. Now, I was listening to some community associations attorneys who are talking about how every once in a while there'll be a push to say, well, condominiums really should be required to fully insure everything. So if, let's say, there's a structural failure in a high rise and unit owners are forced out into hotels, that there could be an insurance settlement where they would get paid for their unit. But the problem with this is that these condominium projects, or many of them, are so expensive that there's no insurance market to buy insurance to cover that.
Yeah.
You'd have to go to Lloyd's of London or something like that, because in America, we've created these condominiums and they have been so widely adopted for all sorts of reasons. And we've created something that there's no real safety net to deal with something if, let's say, a architect made a mistake in designing the structure of it, or the foundation, or the builder made a mistake and it has to be torn down or something like that, or if the repairs are so expensive that it's scary for a lot of people.
It is scary. It's very, very scary. And of course, we're not building them very well. I call them cardboard and scotch tape contraptions, but
right,
you know they're not going to last. They're junk.
Well, so, we could have a whole show talking about.
Actually, it. I did with Tyler Birding from California, and he's actually written. He sent me a very good article that he wrote about the myth of affordable housing. And he talked about the fact that we don't have qualified builders. I think we don't have any adult supervision. I mean, you can't do anything without getting permits. At least I know in Fairfax County, you've got to pay them big bucks to get a permit. But nothing ever happens. They never, ever come and check to make sure that it's being, that the building, things are being done properly. I mean, you're just paying. You're just feeding this insatiable animal there.
Right.
And you're stuck with whatever it is you get. There's no safety net. There's no adult supervision. There's nothing.
Well, the whole permit and inspection process is... It doesn't really work for people who are buying a new home or are doing a renovation. It's something that is very, it sounds like it ought to be consumer friendly, but I've represented property owners and have conversations with builders who have told me that they don't have to listen to me or my client about the construction defects that we have identified because they only have to do what the city or county office requires of them. That's the only, they're the only people they'll listen to about quality control. And you're gonna have to like it or lump it. Of course, this is not a correct legal opinion or legal statement, but it. That's the attitude that you run into, that the purchaser or the owner they're running up against a whole framework of development and regulation where it's as though the owner has all the risk and all the payment obligations, but they don't really, their control or their oversight is minimal, And when there is control and oversight, sometimes it's not clear what needs to be done. I mean, you might need to hire somebody who you'd have to pay $250 an hour to keep track of whether a property is being built properly. For many people, I mean, trying to pay an expert $250 an hour to make sure that your builder is not building defective work because the city or county are just looking at basic safety requirements and not at workmanship. It's just too much. You can't afford that. And most people are stretched so thin in just getting under contract for these projects that they don't have extra money to pay lawyers and expert inspectors and to go through and to advise them on how to decide whether to make a draw payment under a builder contract. It's just too much.
You know, one of the things that that Tyler and I talked about the last time he was on, we're all the crappy construction that we have, and you have these balconies that are coming off. And I went online and I did a Google search for images, and there's so many balconies that nobody made sure that the bolts supposedly holding these balconies up were actually screwed into the building and screwed in to some kind of structural thing that's holding the building up instead of just cardboard and paper. And it just doesn't hold it. The fact that we're paying hundreds and almost half a million, $750,000 for something that's built like that is a total disgrace in this country.
Right, right.
It's a complete disgrace.
Right, and it's sometimes the excuse that the builders always give is it passed inspection.
But it doesn't. They don't inspect.
Well, they inspect, but people don't understand the interest of the local government in this. And the local government wants there to be development. They want to develop a tax base. They want new people to be coming in and moving into their community. They aren't really there to act as the construction defects dispute resolution service, although sometimes they wade into those things for whatever reason. The building codes exist primarily in order to promote safety and health.
Balcony collapsing is not safe.
Right, exactly. But it doesn't always. They don't. If you're out there all the time trying to monitor all these builders, what are you going to do? Are you going to send out a whole army of inspectors? Are going to follow around each and every worker to make sure that each and every worker does something properly before it's covered up with drywall? No. I mean, you're going to assume that the owner, you're going to kind of leave a lot of things to the owner to handle within the context of their contract with the builder. You know, the builder is supposed to build to the specifications in order to get paid the price, and that's true, but sometimes the builders act as though they are completely unaccountable to the people that are paying them and that have signed the contract, and it's very frustrating. I mean, it's with the larger builders, typically what they do is they have these 30-page contracts that have all these arbitration clauses and indemnification, and you've got to send your warranty claim in on pink paper and within 7 months, and you have to do this and that, and there's all sorts of obstacles that make it very difficult to make a defects claim. And then the smaller builders who have shorter contracts, contracts at all, written contracts at all, a lot of them are very fly-by-night operations where if, let's say, you had $30,000, $40,000, $100,000, $200,000 worth of defects, you go and you get a judgment against them, and then they're bankrupt. They have no
John,
money.
We're out of time. I want you to come back and talk about this because this is something that absolutely fascinates me.
Well, thank you.
Next time you come in.
Great. It's been a lot of fun.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.